It's Interstates. I'm Alex Chambers, and we're in the midst of our spring membership campaign. So we have a special episode for you this week. We're not running a whole show on the radio, so this one's going to be shorter. But if you're a regular public radio listener, I think you might be excited about who's on this week, which you probably already know because you've clicked on this episode. In any case, Jada Boomrad is the founder of the smash hit public radio show and podcast Radiolab. Radiolab exploded what narrative audio could sound like. He and his co-host Robert Krulwich made a show that was smart and fast-paced with incredibly detailed sound design, as much musical composition as journalism. At first, Radiolab brought us fascinating human stories and insights from researchers, mainly about science, how the world works, how our bodies work. Listeners often left with a feeling of wonder. At a certain point, Jad shifted his focus to society and politics. He started a spin-off series on the Supreme Court called More Perfect, and then in 2019, he did a series called Dolly Parton's America, which is essentially asking the question, in a time of such incredible political division, what is one thing we can all be excited about? Dolly was the answer. Along the way, he won a MacArthur Genius Award, and the show won two Peabodys. He also built a team of some of the best radio makers in the business, so when he handed off the reins in 2022, Radiolab could go on and continue to evolve. Jad is coming to the Indiana University campus as a patent lecturer next week. We had a chance to talk before his visit. Here's our conversation. What I'd actually like to talk about is interviewing. You know, I know you've the two things when you come to campus, you're going to be talking about interviewing and manhole covers, indoor plumbing.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really about that, but yeah.
Right. I think interviewing is like an interesting thing to be thinking about beyond just the fact that we are both radio producers and it's the main tool of our trade, and that you have been teaching and I also have been teaching podcasting for a long time now. And it was kind of early in teaching that I realized that, like, the title of that talk that you're going to do, How to Talk to a Human, kind of needed to, like, to be the basic thing in the course I was teaching. That these college students were, when I started to see them interviewing each other in class, it was, harder to do than I realized. I mean, it was hard for me, too, actually, when I was younger, and I feel like getting older has helped to a certain degree. I mean, there's always growth to be had there. But also, obviously, like, interviewing is bigger than just podcasting and radio. It's key for being able to interact with people in the world. And so I'm hoping our conversation can also kind of move into some of these bigger questions about society. So the thing I wanted to start with that I'm really curious about, actually, is so you, in a recent TV thing that you did that was, I think, a preview for this similar talk about interviewing, you talked about how at the end of your time at Radiolab, you were feeling like you were having trouble getting to these really good spots in interviews that you used to be able to do. So I wonder if you could talk about that. Like, I'm curious, was it that you had gotten too good at them? Were you burnt out? Did you lose, like, some of the beginner's mind? Where do you think that was coming from?
You know, definitely not that I was too good at it. I always have felt that I'm getting a little bit of an echo. Am I echoing on your
side? I'm not. No, I've just got headphones on. How's that? I just put echo cancellation on.
Hello. Oh, so much better. Yeah. Okay. There we are. You fixed it.
Okay. Great. Awesome.
Cool. So your question was.
It was about, like, you said at the end of Radiolab, you were having trouble getting to these exciting magic moments in conversations.
Yeah. Just to be completely honest, I've always had difficulty interviewing people. Or I should say it's not a natural thing for me. Like, I, as an introverted only child, I'm happy to spend days without speaking to people. But then I get, you know, I think as with most introverts, you get so locked in your own brain that actually it feels like a gift to be able to finally, after days, talk to somebody. But it's always this, like, incredible exertion. And initially, one of the reasons I loved doing the job was that it forced me out of my own head and it forced me to get to talk to people. And, you know, over the years, I built a certain, I guess, I don't even know if I would say a method, but like a comfort level. And I also happened to work with Robert Krulwich for a long period of that. And he's a very forward, energetic interviewer. Kind of like he crowds all the spaces and jumps in a lot and interrupts a lot. And it suited my innate sense of like, I like to sort of sit back a little bit more in conversations. And so it was fun to be able to sort of pair with him. And so I think, you know, so much of my interviewing style was developed in tandem with him. Then he left and I was running the team solo for a long while. And then the pandemic happened, and the pandemic, I think, sent all of us into deep awkwardness, you know? And I don't know, it was something about maybe that sort of pandemic hangover, also managing a team of people where you're having really tough conversations about, you know, all the things that we were talking about in 2020 and should always talk about. Mm-hmm. That sort of like created extra awkwardness. I don't know. And I just found myself around that time talking to, like doing interviews, and I wasn't clicking, you know. I would have these conversations with people and I'd prepare for them and I'd do all my research. But then the thing that you want to have happen in a conversation where you just have like a natural chemistry or a moment or a sense of like warmth grow between two people just wasn't really happening. I would do interviews sometimes where I could feel myself watching myself do an interview, you know? And like, oh, this is the point where I say this, and then they say that, and then I say, really? and then we go to a story.
It feels like maybe was that like a, it feels like that's maybe like a meta moment, because I feel like when you're doing an interview for a production, you're always kind of listening to yourself do it anyway, right? Because you're listening for the beats and you need to figure out what's next.
Absolutely. You're almost like living in two times, right, in a way, because you're having the conversation in the present, but you're also editing it in the future.
Right.
And you're like, ooh, my future self is going to want this and this, and let me say that. And so you're kind of like in two time flows.
And then so this, what you're describing was a third level of being, of like actually predicting, like, oh, this is where I make that move.
Yeah, exactly. And it was the choreography. It's like, you know, when you're dancing and like suddenly you just like, two people are dancing and they're just like stepping on each other's toes and they're somehow not. It felt like somehow my inner sense of rhythm had gotten thrown off, or my sense of the choreography had gotten thrown off. And I was just doing a lot of interviews where it just, that was okay. But no, it didn't get like a real, And so I, as a result of that, I started asking some of the friends in the business, like, so, like, what's your method? Like, what do you do? Not even like when you sit down to do an interview, but before, like, how do you move yourself through the paces? Like, do you meditate? What do you all do? And so I started asking journalists that, and then journalists, we all kind of do the same thing. We're all pretty boring that way. So then I think, well, let me talk to some therapists. So I ended up talking to therapists about how they do it. And therapists, they're all different kinds and they all have different schools. And so that was interesting. And then I ended up actually broadening and talking to salespeople, because salespeople do a lot of interviews, right? Or they have to listen. And so here we're moving away from the traditional broadcast interview just to more like conversation. So I started talking to conflict mediators, hostage negotiators, that kind of thing. I was just got really interested in this idea of like people who have to have conversations for a living, how do they do it? And what can I steal from all of them? What moves, what tricks? In an attempt to sort of reformulate my own way of doing it, you know? And this also happened to be when I was transitioning away from Radiolab and handing the show off. And so I was having larger questions about like, what are the kinds of stories and interviews I want to be doing, you know, in this next phase.
Right, because it was,
so it just felt like a good time to take stock.
Stories.
Like, exactly, yeah.
Some whole new, who knows.
Right. And so I guess it was just a moment to reflect on what it was I was doing for the previous 20 years and what, it's like if you're going on a trip, like what do you want to put into the suitcase? And so I was like packing is kind of how I felt. And yeah, and so the How to Talk to a Human talk, but really it's bigger than that for me. I mean, it's at this point I've done maybe 60, 70 interviews with different interviewers. Maybe one day I'll write a book, I don't know. But that effort really began, it sort of came out of this questioning, that I was having. Yeah.
Did it? So you've moved over to Vanderbilt. I don't know how much, you know, you're just doing some teaching. Did it also come out of that? Sort of the way, like I was saying at the beginning, that I realized my students kind of, that needed to be something we talked about.
Yeah, it ended up being that. When I shifted to Vanderbilt, I've been there about 2 years. Some of the first seminars and lectures I gave were about interviewing. But I was very much, and am still, very much like in the process of this inquiry. And so I'm kind of like learning as I teach a little bit. And the fun part about teaching, I mean, there's a lot of fun parts, but is that it forces you to have to really like get straight on what you think, you know? And so it's been a great motivator. Like, oh, cool, I have to go talk to these students about conversation. And you're right. You know, what you said at the beginning is that, I mean, this is something I think this is especially important right now. If you're in your 20s and you're born into this hellscape of social media where we're all expected to have opinions. And yet if we have the wrong opinions, we're shouted at. Like,
yeah.
It's just, it feels to me like it's just the interpersonal stakes are just higher
and
for kids right now.
Absolutely. Like, I feel like I taught high school for a little while and was teaching like 12 years ago. And even then, my students then were saying that, like, we don't know how to, we're acknowledging, you know, we don't know how to talk to each other. We just text each other all the time.
Right.
And now I have a teenager and I'm like, oh, they don't really talk directly to people, it feels like, that much, you know?
Yeah, I know. And it, I mean, it's funny. I had that issue when I was a kid too. So if,
true.
I feel like
I
we
probably did too.
Maybe unfairly malign this generation when it's actually been an issue all along. I just think it's exacerbated now because so there's so many ways to avoid conversation.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
There was only so many ways you could do that when we were a kid, you know?
Yeah, actually, to connect to your friends, you like still had to talk on the phone. Like,
you did. Yeah. You had to call. I remember calling the person and asking them out, and you really had to sort of, there was...
Terrifying.
That, it was terrifying, yeah. There are all these rites of passage that involved actual face-to-face communication.
Right, right. Which makes me curious. This isn't something you and I have to figure out, but it makes me curious about, like, what are those rites of passage like now? Like, is there a terror about sending the emoji that asks a person out or something now? I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. It's funny. But, you know, the rules of... I think about this often with texting. It's like, the rules of texting are, like... I guess it's like any mediated form of communication. Like, you can say things on text that you wouldn't say face-to-face.
It's true.
And I don't think that's always a good thing.
Yeah.
You know? There is an anonymity to these, or somehow like a... And I think, you know, if you're a marginalized person, that can be a good thing. But I think if you're just trying to, like, get through the day and talk to somebody, I don't know. I see my 14-year-old, the way he behaves, and I'm like, it's, I don't know. It's just different, I guess. I won't qualify it.
Yeah, yeah. I did have two thoughts kind of related to that. It was about the texting and the social media. One is that I think there's the fact that it's more mediated, so that lowers certain kinds of stakes. But then there's, especially in social media versus texting, there's also what you already kind of alluded to, which is the higher stakes of saying something wrong and then getting attacked.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that's been really fun for me, or fun, I don't know if fun's the right word, but it really interesting at Vanderbilt is, I mean, like every college campus, there's a lot of conversation about how do we encourage civil discourse and all that kind of stuff. And I'm actually on a steering committee at Vanderbilt called Dialogue Vanderbilt. So we're always like trying to program stuff that addresses this. But it's really kind of scary to me that, like, if you ask students, and there have been surveys done, like, what are you most afraid of? It's not the big mob, the undifferentiated abstract mob online. It's that I'm going to say something and then my fellow students are going to call me out on social media, like the people I was just in the room with.
Like, I'm going to say something out loud in a room, and then they're going to call me out.
Yes, and then I'm going to get called out on social media by those same people. And that makes me a little sad because, like, you're actually in a room together. You could just yell at each other. I mean, that's healthier.
Way healthier.
just stay in the room and yell.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, that there is something about that that makes me, I don't know, I feel for those kids. Yeah.
Well, so what are some of the things you've figured out that maybe you're hoping to bring to those kids?
There are different ways, there are different useful concepts that I've stumbled into that I find really useful. Let's see where to start. I mean, first of all, there's all kinds of social science research about, or where you sit in relation to somebody else that I've been finding really useful. And a simple move for me that's made a big difference is thinking about triangles rather than sort of face to face, which is very much almost like a rectangle. Our shoulders create a rectangle, but thinking of triangulating to a third point, which is where you sit almost at a right angle to somebody rather than facing them dead on. And our culture sort of privileges this idea of face-to-face communication, just really lock eyes. And that is great if someone's having a really difficult time with something and they need your full attention. But often that kind of face-to-face is too direct. And I've certainly had the experience in interviews where you sort of lose yourself in an interview because it's the person kind of overpowers you. I remember interviewing Dolly Parton, and she was, so charismatic that I could barely get a question in. And I remember in subsequent interviews, I just very naturally decided to sit at a right angle to her. And so I've been thinking a little bit about the ways we orient in space and how that enables certain kinds of conversations.
I feel like that also maybe answers why, driving in a car is a good place to have a good conversation. Or maybe an intense conversation. Because you're oriented.
Yeah. No, because you're side to side.
You're
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a good friend who's a female tell me that she was jealous of male friendships. Because male friendships, males often talk when they're walking side to side. And women often talk face to face. And that can be so exhausting. This is what she was saying. I mean, I don't know if this is true, but I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
It could be a gendered thing here.
Right. Oh, that's so interesting.
But yeah, sort of thinking about orientation and bodies in space has been really interesting to me. One of the other things that I find super helpful is this thing called looping. This is something that comes out of conflict mediation. And then there are different kinds of different versions of this. But basically, it's very simply, you say a thing, I listen to what you say, I try to take what I heard you say, the most important thing I heard you say, and I'm going to say it back to you. So it's, in a way, it's a kind of mirroring. And at the end, I say, did I get that right? And so when you're having a conversation, I love this technique because, and again, social science is very clear on this. We are really bad at getting in each other's heads. And not only bad, we wildly overestimate our ability to get in one another's heads. And they there are any number of ways to demonstrate this. You can show people expressions, facial expressions, and ask them, what is this person feeling? And we think we're really good at this, but we're actually not so good. You can ask people to take surveys of what does their spouse like to eat? What kind of movies does their partner enjoy watching? People think they're going to be great at this. They're going to get 15 out of 20, and typically they get 4 or 5 out of 20, right? So we wildly overestimate our ability to get in each other's heads. And when we talk to each other, very often we're projecting onto a person and then relating to those projections. So we're very much not having a conversation. So I like this looping because it really forces you to slow down and say, okay, you said that thing. I think I heard you say this. Is that right? And then you give the person a chance to correct you if not. And so it's a kind of tempo of conversation. It can be an excruciating conversation because you have to go very slowly. But it forces you to really try to understand what someone is saying by creating a constant audit. And so I tell my students that, It's if you're really in a conflict moment, just slow down and make sure you are hearing what they are intending before you have a response.
Right. It does seem like being able to articulate what the other person said feels like most important in a high stakes conversation. Like, you don't necessarily need to do it if you're, well, I guess you probably do if you're talking about where to go for dinner too.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
Exactly. But I think it's formally, also, I mean, if you understand, like, what does it mean to understand someone? Like, what does it mean to feel heard, right? Is that the phrase we all like to say? And I think what it means is that I can, like, if you feel heard by me, I think what that means is that I am able to state the problems that you are living in language that you would find familiar, you know? So it's the ability to take what you say in and say it in such a way that you would say, yes, that's it, right? And so in that way, it's very simple then. If you want to make somebody feel heard, really listen to them and then say back to them what they just said in language that they would sign off on. So it's like the rudiment of understanding.
Yeah, totally. That was, you know, as someone who got into radio more recently, that was one of the reasons I was excited to get into radio, because I'd come out of academia, did a PhD where I was writing just for other academics about these like high theory kinds of concepts in, you know, in the humanities. And then I got into radio and I was like, oh, the point is to talk in a way that other people are going to understand.
Yeah, I mean, and which is not always an easy sell in academia, you know. Because I think a lot of people in academia, particularly in the humanities, unfortunately, sort of equate talking in a way that people understand with somehow a lesser form of communication.
Not being as smart, not seeming as smart.
Yeah.
We could go into a whole theory about...
That's a whole other dogleg to this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I'm really curious, and this might be a bigger question than we can get to, and I don't know if it's really a follow-up, but it's something I was curious to just hear you think about for a minute, which is more about storytelling. And there might be a connection to communicating, to being able to say things that actually like mean things to other people and that make people feel like their experience is being understood. But it has to do with story and the kind of the rise of story and the ways that, like, I think some people have argued right now, our culture is very kind of storified. Like, so much of what we try to, you know, so much of the information we get is through narrative, whether it's like narrative podcasts like you and Ira Glass helped pioneer, or, you know, social media or TED Talks or whatever. And I've been thinking and talking with a radio friend of mine about whether that expectation makes the kind of harder or more boring parts of life or experience harder to engage with. And this is like, I don't mean like folding laundry. Like, we can listen to a podcast while we fold laundry. But like, whether it's science, whether there's like hard science concepts that we should be thinking about that we can't really fit into a story, or like political organizing where we need to make changes in policies. And I kind of get bored by policy because it's not exciting enough, like a good story.
It's not anecdotal.
It's not anecdotal. And so I just wonder if you like kind of have any thoughts on how you're thinking about story these days in relation to the challenges in society.
Yeah.
No, in like 2 minutes. I mean,
I think you're right. It's the world doesn't exist in story form, you know? I mean, I think for me, it's like, I mean, anyone who does, like, you talk to a historian, right? They'll tell you that, like, we love to tell these pretty little stories about history and how this happened and this happened and then finally this happened. But really, actually, it's so much more complex. And it's like this sort of visual diagram of cause and effect is something more like just an absolute crazy scatter plot. Everything was happening at once. And somebody in retrospect was like, oh, let me come back and just draw a nice little like cut, like a little border through the splatter and say, this is the beginning, this is the middle, and that's the end. So there is something that's like distorting about stories, and that we take the inherent chaos of life and we make it nice and neat and ordered. But there are all kinds of ways to mitigate against that where it's clear to people that stories aren't true. The form of a story isn't inherently better or worse than what existed previous. And, you know, I think it's there is, for me, because I have a lot of the same frustrations that you have, or that you and your friend are sort of pointing at. particularly when it comes to science writing, you know, there was for a long time a kind of popular science template that would happen. Like, here's a study, here's a lesson, here's a study, here's a lesson. And it kind of felt like a very easy story form. Like TED Talks for a while had that kind of like easy to follow template. And so you do realize that there's something, the form itself is carrying some weight that feels maybe distorting is the only word I can think of.
That feels right.
But I also find that it's what you said in your question, I have trouble sometimes processing it unless it has that shape. And so it seems to me that the story shape is fundamentally just a way for us to hold information, you know, because it doesn't go into my brain unless it's story shaped. And I don't know if that's like, has anyone been able to think about statistics in a way that feels vivid without putting it first into a story? I just refuse to think that that's actually possible. And so, you know, the limitations of the story are, I mean, true, but it might just be how we process information. And I think we're getting, you know, I think what you see over narrative, like the history of narrative, is that stories used to be very simple. And then somewhere around Hill Street Blues, right, way back in the day, like stories became much more like fractured and like interwoven. And I think our story shapes now are very sophisticated. So it's about having much more sophisticated stories. And also just the recognition that no one story contains the truth. It's that you have to have a million stories in order to even approximate what's true.
And I guess I would probably say like a million story forms as well.
In a million story
like
forms,
not just a million voices in one story form.
Yeah. Yeah. I would subscribe to that.
Okay. Jed, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Okay, appreciate
it.
Bye. Bye-bye. That's it for the show this week. If you value what we do here on Interstates, now is a great time to show your support. As I mentioned at the beginning, we're in the midst of our spring membership campaign. You can give us a call at 800-662-3311 or go to our membership website at wfiu.org/donate. That's wfiu.org/donate. And let us know what you think. All right, as always, your quick moment of slow radio is coming up. But first, the credits. Interstates is produced and edited by me, Alex Chambers, with Avi Forrest. Our social media master is Jillian Blackburn. We get support from Eabon Binder, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Sam Schemenauer, Peyton Whaley, and Kate Young. Our executive producer is Eric Bolstridge. Our theme song and interstitial music is by Amy Olsner and Justin Vollmer. All right, time for that found sound. That was The Miracle of Indoor Plumbing, which, yes, is the name of one of the talks Jad will be giving here in Bloomington. It's not actually about faucets, though. Until next week, I'm Alex Chambers. Thanks, as always, for listening. Riding back at the top of the Hunter's Moon.